in Gilead to heal the sand-sick soul. There is a balm in Gilead to make the wounded whole. There is a balm in Gilead to heal the sin-sick soul. Sometimes I feel discouraged and think my work's in vain. But then the Holy Spirit revives my soul again. There is a balm in Gilead to make a wounded
by Jesus himself, with some words about people in the society. We always take some time during my address to remember our members and what has been happening in their lives. We've had one death in the society over the past year. I'm a member of the United Church of Christ, and some of you will know that denomination was formed in 1957 through a merger of the Congregational Christian Churches, the descendants of the Pilgrims and Puritans of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, and the Evangelical and Reformed Church, which represents two German migrations to the United States in the 18th and 19th centuries, one to Pennsylvania, originally, the other up the Mississippi River into the Midwestern states of Iowa, Missouri, Illinois, etc. It's a significant denomination in the history of Protestantism in this nation. And the job to which I go is one of the more important jobs in that denomination. It is to be Executive Vice President or Chief Administrative Officer of the United Church Board for Homeland Ministry. The Board for Homeland Ministry claims to be a direct descendant of the Society for the Propagation of the Gospel in the Massachusetts Bay Colony. So it has a long history of mission work in this nation, and is, in fact, probably the wealthiest home mission agency of any Protestant denomination in the United States. To give you some idea of what I will be attempting to manage, the VHM is divided into five divisions. Division of Higher Education, including the American Missionary Association. Some of you will know that the Amstrad Rebellion brought into being the American Missionary Association. And that association was responsible for the congregational work in the South following the Civil War, establishing colleges and schools for black people. And its holdings currently involve funds in endowment for fifth upon an inquiry about God's experiences with human creatures and the experiences of human beings with each other as a result of God's experience. All theological presuppositions in Christianity begin with God, but not only with God, with the initiatives of God. We are who we are because God took action. Thus, in the sense that I'm using theology here, the presupposition is that God is. And that because God is, human beings have a relationship to God and a responsibility to each other. Well, that's the fundamental presupposition upon which I have to work. Now, if you apply that somewhat unsophisticated premise to an administration, It tells you the following things, which I merely want to list and not try to explain. First, God values human life. God is the creator. God would not create if God did not value human life. So we start with the thought that God values human life. Second, God expects us to exist in communities rather than in isolation or solitude. God not only created, God created Adam and Eve so that you get community as the starting point. And community is the basic way in which human beings are expected to live. Third, institutions are one form of human community, even though institutions take a variety of shapes and purposes. Now, I get the personal belief from those three things. I believe that the ideal form of community style and governance is communal, collaborative, and collegial. I'm a congregationalist, friends, and we congregationalists believe in the autonomy and responsibility of each individual, and the freedom and responsibility of institutions. The idea is that we should act together rather than on the basis of hierarchical or dictatorial structure, so that a natural element of community coming out of that view is that compromise is a usual activity in community life for everyone involved in the community or the institution. And so that my style of administration is the attempt to find ways by which individuals and institutions can act with freedom and responsibility toward each other. The purpose of an institution is the next step. Yep. The purpose of an institution is to empower the institution and the persons who are part or object of it to do best what that institution should be about. That is, you do not go and impose on an institution or a person something alien to what that institution should be, or something alien to what that person should be. That means balancing the concern for the best welfare of persons and the best welfare of institutions at all times. You see, this business of freedom and responsibility is really a great balancing act. And in institutions, you've got human beings, which have their own life. The institution as an entity has its own life. And somehow you've got to balance the welfare and the well-being of both. I'm trying to say that if God values human life, persons are required to value human life and human experience also. Not just at the lowest levels of achievement, but at the best level. I tried to demonstrate these beliefs about theological assumptions I have concerning administration, both in my presidency of the society and my presidency of CBA. In each instance, my aim has been to improve the quality of experience for the institution, as well as the quality of the experience of the persons who are part of that institution. Just to demonstrate that a little bit, this society was founded to be a forum for black scholars in religion. What I sought to do in my presidency of it is to be the enabler of opportunities for persons in the society to develop and hone their thinking and their minds in the fullest possible way. It seems to me the responsibility of the president is to make sure that the institution functions so that those of us who are in it can do best what we ought to be about. And what we ought to be about in this society is producing scholarship, thinking through the issues of black religious experience, and so on. And I've tried to take away from the society worrying about funding and all the rest of that. Just as a brief report to you, you'll get the treasury report later, but just as a brief report to you, you ought to know that in the past 2 years, I have not asked for a single penny of expenses from the society, in an effort to let our treasury build up so that we would again be solvent, we were almost insoluble for 3 years ago. But I saw that as one kind of administrative contribution which I could make, given the institution which I'm presiding over presently, and as a way of fulfilling what I've described to you as my beliefs about administration. Well, I want to say also to you in this connection that I want to just briefly review a little bit of what's happening in the 23 years of war that I've been a part of the administration. For me, an end of an era has come. I'm not going to be directly involved with you on the administration. But some of you want to know that in the fall issue of Theological Education, which is published by the Association of Theological Schools, which will be out next month, there is a series of articles by some of us who are members of what is called the Committee on Underrepresented Constituencies of Theological Education. John Cutler has done a lead article of that. They asked me to review the past 20 years of what I had experienced in theological education. As some sort of example of what was going on, I actually went back to 1959, and back in 1959, from a Seabury consultation, in which there were 5 goals expressed by the black and white church people who gathered in Greenwich, Connecticut, the Seabury House. The 5 goals were that we should have greatly increased numbers of black graduate theological students. Second, that there would be sharp growth in the number of black faculty and staff in all theological schools. Third, that there would be significantly improved and strengthened black seminaries. Fourth, that there would be drastic change in the design and content of seminary curriculum. And fifth and finally, that they would develop effective placement systems for black seminary graduates. It's good to recall some of those, but the last one, nobody's ever done anything about it. We've had some progress in 2 of the areas, and in the other 2, we've had some stagnation. I hope you'll read the article. I won't go over the count on that here. Members of the Society have heard me report on this previously, so I won't do that again. But you want to read, especially to read Don Cutline's lead article, too, which is a very important article. What I want to say at this point about these 23 years in theological education is that, apart from those goals, some things have happened because blacks have increased in numbers in theological seminaries across this country. And we ought to know what they are and be proud about some of those things. First of all, quite obviously, black people led the struggle for justice in American theological education. Undoubtedly, without the impetus which we gave, women and all sorts of other groups, Hispanics, Pacific Asian Americans, and all the rest, would not be at the state where they are in their quest for justice. I still go to meetings of the American Association of Theological Schools where there are very few black people, very few women, and so on. But friends, that's not as true as it was 23 years ago, and it's largely because of the effort people in the society exerted to make sure some other people happened. Second, we were pioneers in contemporary curriculum reform. You only have to go back to 1970 to the consultation held at Howard University when we talked about what it would mean if we could blacken theological education. We talked about how we could do that. And we suggested some models for doing it. And let me tell you, curriculum reform has been a major subject ever since. Because every group that comes along behind us, the women and all the rest, want to know how, in fact, they can be included in the stuff of theological education in this generation. We were the pioneers in that. Third, and this will startle some of you, we were strong participants in the concern over the last 20 years about spirituality in American theological education. When I went to CBS in 1974, almost nobody was going to chapel. We began to get some black students at CTS.
Yeah.
And the first thing they wanted to know was, when do we start to worship? That's what black students bring all these ways to. It's a concern about the spiritual life that is not always evident in white Protestant theological education in this country. We've been at the forefront of pushing for what it means to relate to God in some personal ways. The conservatives picked up on that since we began, and they're doing their own thing, but we started some of that stuff. We got the ground up here. Fourth, black people were early discoverers of the need for the seminary to relate to the church. There was a point when I first went to CTS, so in most white theological seminaries, were trying to figure out whether they had looked at the church and how they might relate. And the reason they were trying to discover that was because endowments were down, they needed more money and all the rest of that. They did it for economic reasons, and I'm being overcrass with that. But part of the thrust of the last decade has been the discovery of how theological education and theological seminaries ought to relate more intimately to the life of the church. Well, friends, black students, I remember back in 1968 at Colgate, Rochester, black students were crying that out loud before white folks ever thought about it. Wanted to know how, in fact, their seminary was going to relate them to the church. So we've had some leadership in that school. Finally, black folk have been firm in the commitment to relate religion to community and relations. Now, many theological schools have become very personalized in their religion. But you don't worry about that with black students in most places I know. If we're going to go out and minister, we're going to minister to the whole community. And we want to learn how to do that while we're in school. It's a fundamental commitment out of faith to the fact that we must be responsible in the world and society which we live. When you got poor folk, hungry folk in your congregations every morning, you worry about how they exist in the world day by day. You brought that to your ultimate. Well, I've been talking too long and more than I should. But let me take just one other thought. Then I'll be back. In this issue of theological education, about which I talked, Barbara Hargrove has an article called Modernization of Religion in the New Class. And I want to read two paragraphs from it because they relate to what I started earlier with about myself and my changing language. She says, she points to what is called the rise of what has been seen as a new class in modern society. There is no clear agreement on the definition of this class, first identified with the party elites in Marxist societies, then with the managers of large corporations in capitalist countries. Most recently, the concept has been applied to social service professionals and upper-level bureaucrats. In general, it is understood to be a class whose power base is in expertise rather than in property. The significance of the concept lies in the growing awareness of North American society that the complexities of modern society have created a segment of the population whose managerial skills and access to knowledge and communication systems, as well as governmental channels, has put them in a position of major influence in this society. Now, talking about this class is really the last thing I want to point to, as the kind of example of who I've been. Because it's at that very point of now having developed over 30 years of ministry, the very skills she's talking about, that I'm able to participate at the next level of my career. I've written, I guess, more than anybody else in this room about ministry, qua ministry, among blacks. What I've tried to say in those articles has been that black people in ministry today need to develop more than just the ministerial skill. If you're going to be successful in leadership of the church and society, you need to think about developing multiple competencies. What I tried to do in my career is to develop those multiple competencies so that the next level which opens up is possible for me. Now, whether or not you agree that a new class ought to exist, the fact is it does exist, and it does offer some opportunities for those of us who are interested not just in going to new positions and maintaining the status quo, but going to new positions and transforming those institutions so that they can better serve our people and our cause. This is, in a real way, as I said, my swan song address to this society, this president. I want all of the society members to know that you've been a major influence in my life. And our friendship and fellowship has been one of the signal marks of who I am. And I want to thank you for that. And to tell you, it's time to carry on, friends. Whether I'm looking in the society or in New York doing some other things, my heart will be here, and I'll love you all the way. Thank you.
I was just thinking of all the kinds of things that Shelby and I and Shelby and this society has been involved in. I just saw a kaleidoscope of certain images of the society and its members in Africa at one time. Members of this society serving on a review committee of the Howard School of Religion. This society in its various annual meetings. Members of this society serving on the evaluation committees for the awards from the Fund of Theological Education. And in all of these things, Shelby has been involved. It would be difficult to speak of the training of black ministers over the last 25 years without mentioning Shelby Rooks. Now, some people, since everybody's, so he said this is swan song and all that, some people have had, sometimes had difficulty getting along with Shelby. I will say that. And part of the reason for that is Shelby doesn't like mess. and deeper than that is not just a sort of personal predilection against mess. It's deeper than that. It has to do with the fact that sometimes black folk think that black folks should not hold other black folks responsible. Amen. And therefore, when a black person meets a black person, you just let things slip and slide, and there's no integrity in the relationship. And Shelby said, no, I don't go for that. that black folks are human beings like anybody else, and in any kind of human relationship, one has to have some integrity about it. And this does not exclude black folks at all.
All right.
And some black folks don't like that. And Shelby would just say, well, if they don't like it, they just don't like it. So this business about Shelby, when he spoke about the freedom and responsibility, he means that. And so a part of his ability to have been involved in all of these very fruitful and positive things has been that sense of integrity about relationships. He has exemplified this in all of these kinds of relationships that involve us, and he has also exemplified this in relationship to himself. He not only can be critical of others, he can be critical of himself. He has a sense of knowing what his limits are. He knows what he is able to do, and he knows what he is not able to do. And he'll tell you, I can't do that. So, as Shelby steps down from being president, and that has been important for us, black folk, as a people, kind of like titles. Are you the president? Ooh, you the president. Like, are you head of the thing?
Yeah.
But part of being president of this society, outside of any kind of honor, was the ability of the people in the president of this society to help us. We want a president who can help us out. And when I say help us out, I mean just at the level of getting us some money for stamps. because we don't have any money. And part of Shelby's being president, now he might have thought it was a great honor and all that, but he also would send out stuff, and you know, with the stamps of CTF. I don't mean to tell that. And he would use CTF paper, and he would use their telephone, and he would do all that for us. And so when we get presidents who don't have anything to give us, see, the society wanes. And the reason things go smoothly when Shelby president is because he uses his institution on our behalf. So if you get another president, get somebody who brings something with him. President who's just going to have the honor of being president. Now, see, I don't like Shelby stepping down at this point as president because he got more stuff to give. He just outlined all this stuff. He's in charge of all this money. It's time for him to be president. We could really move up. But given all that, I want to end these few remarks by saying that I feel now in a way that I felt some years ago, around the late 60s or early 70s, when we were just getting some of these things into operation, and a certain feeling of exhilaration that we had, that we were black persons thinking our own thoughts and putting them into operation and feeling good about that. This society didn't have to come into being. It didn't automatically come into being. Mm-hmm. The Fund for Theological Education, as it gave money to black people, didn't have to happen. It just didn't happen normally and naturally. Mm-hmm. Somebody had to make those things happen. Yeah. And the people who made those things happen were black folks. Yeah. And a lot of those black folks are sitting in this room right now. Yeah. Yeah. So we have a little tradition here, and Shelby has been a great part of that tradition. And I should feel that to honor him for what he has been and for his service, we can do no better than to continue that tradition, to enhance it, and to make it better. Thank you.
Thank you.